Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is In Brief. My guest tonight is Boria Sachs. He teaches at Sing Sing Correctional Facility, New York, and online in the graduate literature program at Mercy College. And we're talking about his latest book, Avian Illuminations, A Cultural History of Birds. Boria, it's a pleasure welcoming you back to the station, especially about this book.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be back.
In the introduction, you talk about an avian illumination is almost an experience that you have, that humans have looking at birds. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, in avian, what I call an avian illumination is when people look at a bird and momentarily identify with it to a point when the boundary between person and bird, between human and animal, seems for a minute to vanish. There is a feeling of exhilaration, but then as the bird flies into the distance, there's often a sense of melancholy. This sort of experience is testified innumerable times in poems and in other aspects of human culture. In a way, it is almost institutionalized in the figures of angels, which aren't just Christians, which are also found in Islam and similar composites of avian and human forms are found throughout the world. I believe that even though the way I may describe it could come off to some people as sort of exotic, it is not that at all. It's common, and it is part of the way that we define our humanity. Our humanity consists not in any one very tangible thing, such as our DNA, but much more in our relations with other forms of life. And our relations with birds are certainly at least among the most vivid and most passionate.
I was going to ask you, because I've also had experiences like this with other forms of life too, especially large mammals. I happen to be passionate about snakes. But there's something special about birds. And when you look through your book, which I want to mention for the audience, is beautifully illustrated and also covers an awful lot of ground. There are just numerous examples where cultures have found a strong connection with birds, whether it's an idea, a myth, a religion, in artwork or in poetry. Humans seem to be really awestruck or fascinated, is I think is a better word, with birds.
They do, absolutely. It's funny, perhaps, how there are so many different reasons, so many different rationalizations for bird watching. It can be, as it was in Greece and Rome, a sort of divination.
Yep.
It can be as it is today, rationalized by science. You know, bird watchers keep lists of birds that they see in a season, or lists that they've seen in their entire life, and there's a great deal of emphasis on species identification. But on some level, I suspect that that may be just a rationalization. We say we do it to record species because we live in a culture where people are encouraged to think in very quantitative terms and very scientific terms, and if they did it to say, well, I'm trying to learn the will of the gods, we might think they were sort of crazy, but there's an element of this that I think goes well beyond the reasons that people give.
I could have a conversation with you. I'm a hardcore birder myself. And we could have a whole conversation about that aspect of it. And I think you're on to something. I mean, the passion that's in birding is undeniable, but there's a passion for the exotic, for the unusual, for the rare. And there is a moment when you see something like that, when you see what's called a life bird, the first time you've ever seen it, there is this incredible passion that wells up inside you. That you're seeing something that you've never seen before. Now, I don't want to get into that discussion because we'll talk all day about that.
Well, some other time, perhaps.
Some other time, I think we should have that discussion. I want to talk about flight, though. If there's one thing that many birds, not all of them, have in common, is that they can fly. And it seems to me from the ancient times, people have been envious of birds' ability to fly.
Yes, very much so, and we still are. It's true, we have our airplanes and our rocket ships, but yet, even if you're flying in a plane, you feel just as grounded as if you had never left the Earth. Birds are able to fly in a much more spontaneous kind of way. We fly with machines. They fly with their entire bodies. I think if you were to experience flight from a bird's perspective, it would be sort of like merging with the air. And while perhaps the fact that people fly in all sorts of ways, from air balloons to rocket ships, may on one level have taken some of the mystery about it, we still envy the way the birds can simply ascend into the air without any preparation or forethought, and then move in any direction that they may choose. It's very literally the stuff of dreams.
Right.
Just as we're weightless in dreams, we can go anywhere, but birds can do that while awake.
In your book, there's a wonderful phrase that you use, is we aspire to the lightness of birds. And when you see a bird fly, they don't have a whole other piece of equipment with them. And if you watch a hummingbird is going sideways, backwards, up and down, effortlessly. I mean, they're using energy, but it's their own energy to produce that kind of flight. We don't have that kind of flight.
No, absolutely not. We don't have that sort of spontaneity either. Human flight and the flight of birds are two very, very different things, and their kind of flight is still what we aspire to.
Now, is the story of Icarus and Daedalus wrapped up in that aspiring to flight, and it sort of encompasses that?
Oh, absolutely. I think we can be pretty sure that initially this was a story about shape-shifting. Daedalus was a shaman. Daedalus was able to transform himself into a bird. There's the Greek myths are full of that sort of transformation. But then came a more rationalistic age, and people were more interested in science than in magic, and so the shaman became an inventor. Initially it was about this age-old aspiration to be a bird, to fly like a bird. In a sense, Icarus embodies the failure of this aspiration for human beings. But Daedalus remained the prototype of a inventor literally for millennia. And people like Leonardo da Vinci, who wanted to build flying machines, would always model them after birds, as Daedalus is alleged to have done, until finally in the 18th century, people managed to fly, not by copying birds, as it turned out, but with an air balloon.
Right. You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Boreas Sachs. He teaches at Sing Sing Correctional Facility, New York, and online at the Graduate Literature Program at Mercy College. We're talking about a wonderful book that has just come out by him called Avian Illuminations, A Cultural History of Birds. Boreas, you have a really interesting section on fantastic birds. And we're talking about things like the phoenix, the fenhuang, the simorgh, the rook. These fantastic birds are I've always been intrigued by. But as you write, they're actually, when we talk about the phoenix, everybody knows and has heard the word phoenix, but there are actually few stories about the phoenix.
Yes, that is remarkable, and that applies to fantastic birds in general. Fantastic mammals, fantastic reptiles, dragons, centaurs, all of these impress us mostly through their stories. But fantastic birds work not so much through stories, but simply through their presence. Simply by appearing in the sky, they tell us a lot about the future and about our place in the cosmos. But because they are not so much the stuff of stories, or not primarily, the lore of fantastic birds does not have the same sort of literal quality that that of other fantastic creatures does. You know, nobody really argues very much. Nobody ever has argued about whether the phoenix comes from India or Arabia or someplace else. All of these have been stated, but people are less literal-minded when it comes to these fantastic birds. Birds like the phoenix and the rook and the simorgh and the ho-ho and
yep.
the firebird are, to a certain extent, almost interchangeable, and people are not terribly concerned about very literal kinds of descriptions.
There, you quote The Conference of Birds by Sufi poet Farid ud-Din Attar. It's a work that I'm familiar with, and I love the fact that you referenced it in this book several times. In that poem, each species of bird represents a different type of human. And at
Absolutely.
The very end of it, they sort of congeal and form a huge, fantastic bird.
Yes, indeed. That's a very good way of putting it. In other words, you know, finally, there's only the individual and God, and that distinction alone seems to vanish. This is perhaps taken to its ultimate form, the experience of an avian illumination.
Let's talk about individual birds for a second, or group of birds. Owls. Owls have had a weird relationship with human society. Part of the fact is that they were nocturnal, and that was always thought to be rather unnatural. But they've been omens of death and madness and strange things.
Absolutely. The representation of owls has been remarkably consistent by comparison with that of other birds. They're constantly associated with witchcraft, with with esoteric knowledge, with magic, and in cultures which are otherwise very diverse and may have had very little contact with one another, the representation of owls is surprisingly consistent.
It's really, really fascinating. There's a poem, another poem. This is a 12th to 13th century medieval, I think it's an English poem, called The Owl and the Nightingale. What did those two birds represent?
They represented, respectively, the morality of the church and the morality of courtly love. Both of them are nocturnal. In the night, in the poem, they have an argument about which is better. Finally, the issue remains undecided. And while it is on one level an argument, they both seem to appeal to a similar set of values in the end, indicating, I think, that the morality of the church and that of courtly love are really ultimately not so very far apart. But it's a very colorful poem. The nightingale and the owl exchange all sorts of jibes and colorful taunts and insults, but yet you have a feeling that behind it all, they are ultimately agreed.
Again, this is another example of how human cultures have used birds to represent or to stand in for aspects of our society. Another example is Aristophanes' play The Birds, where that essentially was a parody of human society at the time, right?
Absolutely, yes. This is a idea that seems to come up over and over again in many diverse cultures, the sense that the world of birds is a mirror of our own, that everything that happens in our world corresponds to something in theirs, that every division between different kinds of birds corresponds to some sort of division among people. You have that in Greco-Roman culture. You have that in China, in medieval Britain, and there are many early modern and even contemporary examples of it.
Now we're just giving a brief description of what Boria has written extensively in these different chapters. You have a great chapter on falconry and the origins of falconry, and you write that there's a connection between falconry and erotic and romantic love. Can you describe that?
Well, first of all, there is a very old association between romantic love and hunting. Analogies between amorous intrigue and the way that a hunter tries to surprise and locate the bird, there is often a sense that hunting is actually consensual. The American Indians, for example, the Plains Indians, would believe that when a deer turned around and faced them, it was in effect, allowing itself to be killed. And predator and prey, hunter and hunted, ultimately become a single being in a way like lovers. Now, these analogies are rather esoteric. But in the case of falconry, it was very closely, especially closely, associated with romantic love. And the way that a bird of prey would suddenly turn and pounce suggested the suddenness with which somebody can fall in love. It was very common for knights and ladies to be painted, to together holding their falcon, the falcon representing their relationship, sort of in the same way as a man and women would be photographed together with their dog today. And, of course, both men and women regularly engage in falconry together, and so it was an opportunity for them, even in cultures where their lives were in many contexts separate, to socialize and to engage in courting and everything connected with that.
We're completely out of time, and we've barely scratched the surface of this book. There's so much in it. One of my favorite things in this book is Plato's defining man as a two-footed, featherless animal, which is also the description of a plucked chicken. This is just a beautiful book to read and a wonderful book to look at. My guest tonight has been Boreas Sachs. He teaches at Sing Sing Correctional Facility, New York, and online in the graduate literature program at Mercy College. And we're talking about his latest book, Avian Illuminations, A Cultural History of Birds. Bori, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.